Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya.
July 27th, 2015, Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 5, Vidura's Talks with Maitreya, Text 11. Kastripnuyatirta paro vidhanat.
Kastripnuyatirta paro vidhanat.
Satre shuva suri bir idjamanat. Ya karna nadim purushasya yato. Bhava pradam geharatim chinati.
Bhava pradam geharatim chinati.
Please chant. Who is that man?
Who is that man?
Tripnuyat.
Tripnuyat.
That can be satisfied.
That can be satisfied.
Okay, now we're ready.
Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Who in human society can be satisfied without hearing sufficient talk of the Lord, whose lotus feet are the sum total of all places of pilgrimage, and who is worshipped by great sages and devotees? Such topics can cut off one's bondage to family affection simply by entering the holes of one's ears. Purport. Krishna Katha is so powerful that simply by entering into a person's ear, it can at once give deliverance from the bondage of family affection. Family affection is an illusory manifestation of the external energy, and it is the only impetus for all mundane activities. As long as there is mundane activity and the mind is absorbed in such engagement, one has to undergo the repetition of birth and death in the current material existence. People are most influenced by the mode of ignorance, and some are influenced by the passionate mode of material nature. And under the spell of these two modes, a living being is actuated by the material conception of life. The mundane qualities do not allow a living entity to understand his real position. The qualities of both ignorance and passion strongly bind one to the illusory bodily conception of the self. The best among the fools who are thus deluded are those who engage in altruistic activities under the spell of the material mode of passion. Bhagavad Gita, which is direct Krishna Katha, gives humanity the elementary lesson that the body is perishable and that the consciousness, which is spread throughout the body, is imperishable. The conscious being, the imperishable self, is eternally existent and cannot be killed under any circumstances, even after the dissolution of the body. Anyone who misunderstands this perishable body to be the self and who works for it in the name of sociology, politics, philanthropy, altruism, nationalism, or internationalism, under the false plea of the bodily conception of life, is certainly a fool and does not know the implications of reality and unreality. Some of them are above the modes of ignorance and passion and are situated in the mode of goodness. But mundane goodness is always contaminated by tinges of ignorance and passion. Mundane goodness can enlighten one that the body and the self are different, and one in goodness is concerned with the self and not the body. But due to being contaminated, those in mundane goodness cannot understand the real nature of the self as a person. Their impersonal conception of the self as distinct from the body keeps them in the mode of goodness within material nature. And unless they are attracted by Krishna Katha, they will never be liberated from the bondage of material existence. Krishna Katha is the only remedy for all people of the world because it can situate one in pure consciousness of the self and liberate one from material bondage. To preach Krishna Katha all over the world, as recommended by Lord Chaitanya, is the greatest missionary activity, and all sensible men and women of the world may join in this great movement started by Lord Chaitanya. Yas tripnuyat tirtha pado bahanat satre shiva suribi ijamanat ya karna nadim purushasti yato bhava pradam geharatim chinati. Who in human society can be satisfied without hearing sufficient talk of the Lord, whose lotus feet are the sum total of all places of pilgrimage, and who is worshipped by great sages and devotees. Such topics can cut off one's bondage to family affection simply by entering the holes of one's ears. So here Vidura is going on from the previous verse where he said he's not satisfied by material topics, he wants devotional topics, and explaining why, that they're actually fully satisfying, and not only are they fully satisfying, but bhava pradam geharatim chinati. Chin means, when we have the demons torturing Prahlad Maharaj, chindi, chindi, they're cutting him up. So chin means to cut up. And what are they cutting up? They're cutting up this bhava, pradam bhava, here meaning the material world, and geharatim, attachment to one's home here in the material world. Geha means home. So having the misery and being attached to it, having a miserable living position and being attached to it. So what's our problems here? Vidura very nicely explains what's our problem in a very succinct form, and very succinctly again gives the cause and the most elegant solution, which Prabhupada expands a bit on this purport. So our problem is this bhava pradan, that we're in this material consciousness. And in this material consciousness, we have four miseries: birth, death, old age, and disease. So birth is miserable, being packed up in the womb. And of course, nowadays, you're afraid that your mother's going to kill you in the womb. So it's really bad when a criminal hurts you, but when the policeman hurts you, it's worse. And recently in America, there's a lot of stories about abuse by police officers, sometimes just of somebody standing around doing nothing. So when the police officer is the criminal, it's much more serious than when the criminal is the criminal, right? When you get hurt by your shelter, that's really bad. So the shelter in the womb, you're supposed to be taken care of, most protected, so many layers, bag of water, the mother's body, and mother is supposed to be the greatest well-wisher. There's supposed to be no love higher than the mother love. Even in animal society, the maternal instinct is the strongest above any other instinct. But your mother may kill you. So misery in the womb, and then the process of birth, where you forget right in the womb, you remember your past 100 lives, and the process of birth, it's so traumatic. You forget everything, and then there you are in a new body. You don't know how to operate. No idea how to work this thing. And you don't know how to communicate, you don't know where you are, you've lost everything. You know, you've lost everything. So that's the misery of birth. Something like if you got into a car accident and you ended up in a coma and you woke up and you didn't know who you are, you didn't know how to move your body, you didn't know how to talk, you didn't know how to read, and you lost all your identity. I know one devotee that this happened to. She was in a car accident, she got in a coma. When she got out of the coma, she had lost her identity. She didn't know anyone, she didn't know anything. It was like being born again. So that's very miserable. And then death, of course, is the birth and death, two sides of the same coin. Death is miserable because, again, that's the process of losing our identity, our possessions, our relationships, everything. You know, worse than having your house burned down. And then old age, you don't have the same kind of energy, the different organs and parts of the body don't function as well as they used to anymore. That's something like driving a really old car that just doesn't operate the way that it's supposed to. It's the things that you take for granted that the body is able to do, the body can no longer do very nicely anymore. And disease, of course, is the worst because there's so much physical pain, mental pain, incapacity. Serious disease is almost like being a ghost, where you have desires and you can't act on them because your main organ of action is not properly functional. And then the three sources of misery, the body and the mind. So those four are all body and mind. And then just mental anxieties and so forth. And then other living entities. So much pain from our human relationships. We get so much pain from the human relationships, often the ones that are supposed to be, again, the shelter. Like the womb's supposed to be the shelter, the mother may kill you. So the very relationships that we take as our primary shelter, mother, father, sister, brother, husband, wife, son, daughter, these are relationships often cause us the most pain. I think half of all murders is between intimate romantic partners. So much pain from other relationships. What to speak of other people in general, some store clerk or whatever, you know, who gives you the wrong deal, doesn't listen to what you have to say, and then the bugs that bite you or crawl around your house, barking dogs and so forth and so on, governments, businesses, and then from the weather, too hot, too cold. I mean, here in Hawaii, I consider it pretty much perfect weather, but even here we have very heavy rain. Sometimes it's too hot. What to speak of in the rest of the world where generally it's too something, too hot, too cold, too windy, too wet, too dry, something. You know, it's rare that the weather is perfect. And then natural disasters, hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes, tsunamis, and so forth and so on. So all those miseries. And then our emotions and desires, which should be the very source of our happiness, are often the very source of our misery, our anger, which comes upon us like a sudden earthquake without warning, and where we say and do things to cause pain to ourselves and others. Lust, uncontrollable lust that causes us, again, to engage in relationships that are embarrassing and entangling, ruin our lives. And greed, which causes us to feel this lack of satisfaction, to accumulate more than what we need. Envy, which damages our relationships with others and burns our heart. I mean, all of these, this is just, we can go on and on and on with these miseries. It's amazing to me that materialistic people are able to be in this materialistic consciousness and say, I'm happy. You know, I'm doing great. While they're beset with birth, death, old age, and disease, adiatmic, adidaivic, adibautic, and lust, anger, envy, greed, and so forth. You know, and these things are constant. If you spend any time at all with materialistic people after being with devotees, there it's so noticeable how much they're suffering, much more than spiritually enlightened people, and yet how unaware they are of their suffering, or how they just blame their suffering on their circumstances. It's quite interesting. So what is the cause of all this suffering? What is the cause? The cause, by the way, is not just that one has a material body, or that one is physically situated in the space of a material planet. That's not really exactly the cause. The cause here is that we have the wrong object of affection. So Vidura uses this term, rati. He says, bhava pradam geha rati. So it's not just the talks about Krishna chinati, break the bhava pradam, the taking the step over and over again in material life, but they break the cause, which is, here, geha ratim. Ratim is an interesting word. Rati is also a person. She's the wife of Cupid. And rati is associated not just with attachment, but being the wife of Cupid, one could say even with erotic attachment, or very strong attachment, great love. The kind of crazy, wild, all-encompassing, deep, irrational attachment that people have when they're attracted to a romantic partner. This is rati. It's not just a minor attachment. It's not like, oh, I like that chair, but if the chair disappeared tomorrow, it wouldn't be a big deal to me. It's not that kind of attachment. It's this really deep, almost crazy attachment is rati. So geha rati, geha literally means home. And here Prabhupada's translating it as family affection. But it can be expanded a little bit beyond that. We're attracted to our home in this world. We're attracted to our identity. Family, attraction to family means I'm attracted to a particular identity. I'm attracted to saying, you know, I am so-and-so's child, I am so-and-so's spouse, I am so-and-so's parent and sibling. I belong to this family. I am one with them. This is my identity. And seeing the family as objects for our enjoyment, seeing the family as extensions, Prabhupada calls it extended selfishness. Just like I have this false belief that the senses are, of my body are objects for my enjoyment. They're my servants. My eyes are supposed to serve me. My nose is supposed to serve me. My hands are supposed to serve me. And when they don't, I become disturbed. Why aren't you serving me properly? Why aren't you doing what you're supposed to do when I tell you? And the family becomes an extension of that. It's my mother, my sister, my son, you know. And they are an extension of my identity, and they expand the scope of my ability to enjoy, because my own senses are very limited. There's only so much I can do with my own senses. So I think my family as an extension of myself, so they're going to get me pleasures that I'm not able to get on my own. They expand the scope of my ability to enjoy and control the world. So therefore, I have this deep attachment to family. And then it extends, of course, to community. My family is part of a community. It's part of a community of a nation. You know, all the other Slovakians, or perhaps a religion that I see like a nation, all the other Protestants, all the other Sunni Muslims, you know, it goes up to all the other humans, or everyone of my race, all the other black people, all the other, whatever. I extend the concept of extended self and family to go beyond people who are related to me in terms of my birth from a particular mother and father. I go beyond that. Like Prabhupada talks about this in the preface of Nectar Devotion, that at first one just loves one's mother, and then that extends to one's father, and then to one's brothers and sisters, and then to the people that your family identifies as belonging to your group. These are the people my parents introduced me to, my brothers and sisters, etc., introduced me to as becoming part of my group. And I look for people who are part of my group, swajana, my people. This was Arjuna's problem in the Bhagavad Gita, my swajana. And I make these my deep object of affection because I'm convinced that they can satisfy me in ways that I'm not able to do for myself. I want to become part of a greater whole. And I identify with them. As much as I identify with the body, which Prabhupada talks about a lot here in this purport, then I identify with this extended body. And the problem is that I have nothing to do with any of this. As Prabhupada says a number of times here in this purport, I am not this body, I am not this identity, I have nothing to do with the world. But because I want to try to enjoy separately from Krishna, and I cannot live without rati, I cannot live without this affection, so I get this illusory identity. And I transfer then the affection that is meant to be given to Krishna and meant to be given to Krishna's eternal associates, I transfer that to illusory representations of that. So rather than Krishna's family and Krishna's associates and Krishna's pastimes and Krishna's name, I transfer it to my abode, my geha, my home, my family, my nation, my activities, etc., and pour all of that affection that is meant for Krishna into those. Now, how can I do that? When we say it, put it like that, the whole thing becomes so absurd that you think, well, how could we do that? How could we take the affection that's meant for Krishna, this madness of love that's meant for Krishna, and instead pour it into these things? Well, one has to be under the modes of material nature. You know, if somebody wants to feel very strong and powerful, they drink alcohol, and then they think they sing very nicely and they're very clever, when they're not. I mean, instead of becoming actually clever, they just drink some alcohol and they imagine that they're very clever. Right? So Krishna says, all right, you want to be God. You can't be God. But I can make it so you imagine that you be God. So take this intoxicant. So this goodness, passion, ignorance are different kinds of intoxicants. Take these intoxicants, and then you can actually imagine that what you're doing makes sense. You can imagine that if I pour all my rati into my home, my family, my nation, my community, my body, that then I'll become satisfied. That then I will get all my desires fulfilled. just like the drunk person thinks, you know, if I sing, everybody will appreciate my singing. If I dance, everyone will appreciate my dancing. And I'm driving straight on the road and so forth. And here Prabhupada talks about in this purport that people are mostly in the mode of ignorance. Now, although he doesn't say it here in the purport, certainly this refers to the time of his writing, because in previous yugas, people were not mostly under the mode of ignorance. So in the mode of ignorance, one has this geharatim in a very gross animalistic form. One is thinking that I will enjoy my senses and my extended senses of family, nation, community in any way possible, without any sort of religion, without any sacrifice. Just let me get enjoyment without sacrifice. And certainly this mood is what's dominant in today's world. And we really have to say, frankly, it doesn't matter where you go. It's really not that some countries in the world are less in the mode of ignorance. I just don't see it. I see that different countries, different groups of people may be more in the mode of ignorance in some things. You know, you have the European countries are going to be more in the mode of ignorance about meat eating than they are in India. But they're going to be less in the mode of ignorance about keeping their public places clean. I mean, it just, people are generally right now on the planet in the mode of ignorance. Let me do something without sacrifice. The food is being produced in the mode of ignorance with the chemicals that make the crops grow very quickly and artificially produce more than they're meant to artificially have fruits out of season at the cost of damaging the soil, damaging the air, damaging the water, and even making food that's not very nutritious. So this, it's a simple example of what the mode of ignorance is about. I want more variety of food and more food right now, and so I'm just going to do it in the fastest, simplest, easiest, cheapest way without a consideration of the consequences. Of course, what's interesting is that food grown like that doesn't even have the flavor that naturally grown food has. So your enjoyment from the food itself is greatly diminished even at the time of your eating it. Plus, what to speak of the fact the food is causing you personally so many diseases and then is polluting the whole environment that you live in. And after a while, the soil becomes sterile. You can't even grow anything on it anymore. So this is just, as I say, one simple example. We could talk about anything, how the whole meat-eating industry, the whole trend towards separating sex from reproduction, you know, everything is just gone into a... the idea of how people entertain themselves nowadays. So everything has just gone very strongly to the mode of ignorance. And then Prabhupada talks about the mode of passion, that better than those in the mode of ignorance are the mode of passion. And I think this, it's important to realize that passion is greater than ignorance. In the mode of passion, a person still has this mood of this this ratim for the geha ratim. But now they're trying to do it through sacrifice. They want to be a good person in the world. They're not just willing to take without thinking of the consequence. So here we have responsible people. And people talk about corporate responsibility and responsible government and caring government and, you know, organic growing of food, taking, you know, not divorcing, taking responsibility for your children, and all this is very much in the mode of passion. And Prabhupada talks about how altruistic activities are very much in the mode of passion. I find that devotees, often I'll hear devotees talk about how charity is mostly in the mode of goodness, but it isn't. First of all, there's charity in all three modes, but this concept of being very altruistic and philanthropic is a particular aspect of the mode of passion. Because in the mode of passion, one is very, very much into this extended sense gratification through pious means. So one is going to, and with hard work. In the mode of ignorance, you don't want to do any hard work and you don't care about the means. In the mode of passion, you take pious means and you're willing to work very hard. People in the mode of passion are willing to go through tremendous endeavor to try to have this extended sense gratification in a pious way. And then people in the mode of goodness, of course, there's levels in the mode of goodness. The lowest level of the mode of goodness, as Prabhupada says in the Bhagavad Gita, are poets and philosophers. And the higher levels of the mode of goodness, they're interested in Brahman realization. They're interested in understanding that the self is different from the body. And people in the mode of goodness are not running around over-endeavoring. They're satisfied with what comes of its own accord. But unlike the person in the mode of ignorance who's just lazy, the person in the mode of goodness is satisfied. Now, the problem here with goodness, Prabhupada says, is that it's still contaminated by passion and ignorance. And one is still having this mood that I am the center of the universe. It hasn't gone away. It's just that I've become the center of the universe, spiritually speaking. That I'm Brahman, I'm God. So that doesn't really give you satisfaction either. So the real solution to all this is to change the object of the rati. To change the object of the rati to the real object. And Prabhupada talks about this analogously in terms of watering the root of the tree instead of watering the leaves, feeding food to the stomach instead of feeding food to some other part of the body. You know, you could stick a tube in your nose and feed your stomach that way. You know, you could stick a tube up the anus, I suppose. But that's not the real way to feed the body. The food is supposed to go into the mouth. What to speak of if you just kind of pour food over the body, you know, or you just stick food up your nose, that's not going to do much. So one has to give food in to the proper object. And all of our suffering, all of it, 100%, all of our entanglement, everything is due to having the improper object of affection. Everything. And when one has the proper object of affection, then one lives very happily in this world, not because the world becomes what we want materially. This is a very big mistake. People think, well, if I become a spiritual or religious person, then I'll become rich and healthy and beautiful and a powerful controller. I'll become expert, basically, in the mode of passion, or I'll become expert in the mode of goodness. A person may take the spiritual life if they want to become expert in the mode. Of course, some people maybe want to become expert in the mode of ignorance. We have that, too. You know, God is on my side as a terrorist. So we have that. And then we have God is on my side, and I will become a great philanthropist, and I'll feed all the people in Africa. And in this way, I will get my name in history books. And if I have God on my side, I'll have a happy family, and everybody will love me, and everyone will do what I want because I'm a religious person. Or in the mode of goodness, one will think, I have God on my side, and therefore I will have all the good qualities. I will be equipoised, I will be peaceful, I will be charitable, I will be kind, etc. I will be a wonderful person. If I'm very spiritual, I'll be, and then I won't be affected by the material world. But the ratting that we're talking about here is different. This is having the right object for the right reason. And I wanted to refer to Raghunath Das Goswami's Manashiksha, which is what I'm working on right now, where he also uses this word, rati. So he gives a list of what are the proper objects for our rati. He says, Guru Gosti Gostalishu Sujane Bhusuragane Swamantre Srinami Vrajanava Yuvidande Sharane Saradambam Hitva Kuru Ratim Apurvam Atitaram Aye Swantar Bratas Chatubi Abhiyase Jitapada. He says, O dear brother, O mind, having given up all pride, please bestow unprecedented and excessive attachment on Sri Guru, on Sri Vrindavan, the abode of cows, on the devotee residents of this abode named Vrindavan, on all the devotees present on this planet, on the confidential mantra given by Sri Guru, that's the Gayatri mantras, on the holy names of their lordship, Sri Radha Krishna, and on the process of smaranam, that is, remembering the fresh youthful couple of Raja. Holding your feet, I beseech you with sweet words. So what are the objects of rati that we're supposed to get? Okay, so we have Sri Guru. This is our Diksha Guru and our Shiksha Gurus. And Raghunath Das Goswami explains in verse 2, the kind of rati we're supposed to have to Guru is as Mukunda Presta, one who's very dear to the Lord, not independent of the Lord. Then he says Gosta. Gosta is the place of the cows. So this is Sri Vrindavan Dham, and that's our real home. That's our real home. So we're very attached to Guru, who's very dear to Krishna. Like we say, Kintu Praburya Priya Evatasya. Very. Then we become very attached to our real home, to the home of the Lord, the place of the cows. Then Sujana. Sujana means very nice people. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur commenting on this says, these are devotees of the Lord that may belong to any Vaishnava Sampradaya. He says they may not reside in Vraja even in their meditation, but they're bona fide devotees. They're Majjhima devotees. And Gostayalin, these are the residents of Vraja. So these are people who live in Vraja either physically or mentally. These are the Uttama Bhaktas. And then the Bhu Suragana. Of course, in today's verse, we have Suribi also by the great devotees. So this Sujana, these are people who, I'm sorry, Bhu Sura Gana. Bhu is the earth, Sura is the pious people, Gana is the group. And these are people who follow Varnashram. These are the pious religious people. They're the Kanista Adhikaris. They're not very advanced, but one should have Rati for them too. Then Swamantra. We should have Rati or great attachment to our Diksha Mantra. The Brahma Gayatri Mantra, Guru Gayatri, Gora Gayatri, the Gopal Gayatri, which Sanatana Goswami, of course, has written a whole book on the Gopal Gayatri Mantra, and the Kama Gayatri Mantra. Then Sri Harinam, the names of the Lord, and of course that's alluded to in today's verse, where Abhidhanat, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur in his commentary on today's verse, talks about Abhidhanat as referring to Krishna's name or Krishna's pastimes. So these are names such as Hari, Radhakanta, Krishna, Govinda, etc. Right? Petita Pavana. So these are names that are listed by Bhaktivinoda Thakur in commenting on Raghunath Das Goswami's verse. And he does say names like Paramatma are secondary names, and we should have this Rati for the primary names. Then the next object of affection, Rajanava Yuva Dwandva Sharana, surrender to the youthful couple of Vraj. And Raghunath Das Goswami says this is a Purva Rati. This is a love inherent in the soul, which is a pure love. And how should we develop this love? Raghunath Das Goswami says, Atitaram Kuru, with intense endeavor. Then also in this verse, he says, Saradamba Damban Hitva, always give up pride. So one cannot develop this Rakti for all of these, for the Guru, for the land of Vrindavan, the Uttama Adhikaris, the Majjhima Adhikaris, the Kanista Adhikaris, our Diksha Mantra, the name of the Lord. If we want to at the same time maintain our pride as being part of this world, this pride means all these false identities. But it's our Rati that gets, for these wonderful things, that gets rid of our pride. So it's not that we can get rid of our pride first, but we develop the Rati for the proper source first. As we do that, the other naturally slackens. If you start putting food in your mouth, you won't want to put it in your nose anymore. So this is our real solution. Because as soon as we start getting this deep Rati for our real home, for the Lord, for His holy name, and so forth, then we see that our attachment for the material things is just foolish. And all of us who take to Krishna consciousness have this practical experience, that as we develop more and more attachment to Krishna, we naturally become disgusted. Not in a rasa sense of disgust, but we just become disinterested, perhaps is a better word, although the Prabhupada and the Acharyas do use the word disgust, but we become disinterested in the material Rati, because there's no Rati in it. It's just a chewing the chewed. The rice is gone. It's just the outer husk. It looks like something. It looks like there'll be pleasure there, but there really isn't. It's simply quarrels and strife, especially in Kali Yuga, and just more and more suffering, this whole web of suffering. And you just say, I don't want to get involved in that. Does that mean that a devotee lives aloof from everyone in society and doesn't have a family and doesn't have a nationality? Well, sometimes. We do have some devotees who live as avadutas. I'd say even in our present society of Vaishnavas, we certainly have devotees who live like that. There was one of my godbrothers who recently passed away in Vrindavan, Radhapati. He definitely lived like that. He lived just aloof from everyone and everything, and just serving the cows and bringing milk to Krishna and Balaram every day. But in general, that is not the way that we demonstrate having the proper rati, because Prabhupada at the end here, he says that we should preach Krishna Katha all over the world as recommended by Lord Chaitanya. It's the greatest missionary activity, and all sensible men and women of the world may join in this great movement started by Lord Chaitanya. So to spread this attachment for Krishna all over the world, one has to be functioning in the world. You know, there's no way to be a preacher in the world as an avaduta. So at least to some extent, one functions in the world. And also because generally, for most of us, there is a gradual and proportional change of our object of attachment. So we may need some support of family and job and so forth in the world while we're making this transition. And then what should happen is not that one becomes disgusted by one's family, but one sees one's family as they are. So if one's family is Kanista, Majjhima, Uttama Bhaktas, then one can have rati for them. Isn't that fascinating? But from a different perspective and for a different reason. Not as objects that are going to fulfill the desires I cannot fulfill for myself, but as living beings with free will who are making Krishna happy, and therefore I love the fact that they are making Krishna happy, even if they're doing so as Kanista Adhikaris. And if one says, well, my family members are not even Kanista Adhikaris, they're out and out atheists or agnostics or something like that, then one sees Jivarasorab Hayakrishnaranya Chidasha. Everybody is a servant of Krishna, and I see them as potential devotees. So in this way, one doesn't necessarily have to leave, but one changes from seeing the world, from being attached to the body, the family, and the world as my object of enjoyment, and instead being attached to Krishna, that I'm his object of enjoyment, and being attached to everything in relation to Krishna because it is giving Krishna pleasure. And as soon as one does that, as soon as one does that, the influence of the modes abates. And when the influence of the modes abates, one sees the world as it is. And when one sees the world as it is, without the veil of Maya, then the world is no longer capable of causing any misery. Just like when one sees a dream as a dream, the dream no longer can cause misery. Or I give the example many times, if you go to a shop where they're selling television sets, and there's some movie playing or some TV show playing on the set, so they want to show how well the set works, so they're always playing something. But if you're not watching it, you don't feel any misery from, you know, as you're walking past it, someone is crying. But because you're not watching the show, you're not attached to it, it doesn't cause one any misery. So you see, oh, it's just some show. Or if you could go on the set. So I've said this before, when I was 10, I went on a television set in Hollywood. And if you're there on the set, the people there, they're not really experiencing those emotions. It's not that the director and the producer and the cameraman, when they're watching the actors, they're not experiencing the emotions that the audience is later experiencing, because they see things as they are. They see that those things are not really happening. Once you know the magician's secrets, then when you watch the magician, you don't feel that sense of wonder and surprise anymore. You see it for what it is. So once the veil is removed, then there's no longer any attachment to the world as sense objects, and then there's no longer any misery from the world. So if we have any questions or comments...
The example of a devotee who had some traumatic experience where she basically forgot everything, her identity, etc. And so one of the things we learn is that materially, that as we pass from one life to another, whatever we've accomplished essentially is lost. Of course, we take our karma with us. But from a spiritual perspective, that which is gained is never lost. Neha bhikkhavanashasi praknavayana vijate svalpam apyasya dharmasya trayate mahatobaya. So what happened with her when she came out of that, what happened? Did she, to her devotional practices,
they stopped completely.
Did that recover?
No.
At least in this life?
No. Not at all.
Well, we know then it'll spring back up in her next life.
Perhaps. I mean, and as far as I know, she's still living, although she's probably quite elderly at this point. But even for us, I was once at New Vrindavan during the Festival of Inspiration, 300, 400 devotees. And I asked the question, how many of you are convinced that you had some contact with Krishna consciousness in a previous life? And almost everybody, well over 90% of the people, raised their hand. However, we may not be aware of that immediately. You know, if we take birth in a family that's not devotees, we may not be aware of it immediately. And even you take birth in a family of devotees, you may not be aware of it immediately. You may not be aware of your previous connection. It may take some time in the right situation to fructify again. And I think one of the reasons for this is we have many different desires. So if we have a desire for... I was just reading in the Bhagavad Gita in the 6th chapter, where Arjuna asks Krishna, what's the fate of the transcendentalist who doesn't finish? Right? And in Vishnu Chakravarti Thakura's commentary, he talks about it depends why the person didn't finish, what was the reason for the fall down, and that, especially for a beginner, that their next birth is going to be in heaven, where they get to fulfill all the desires that cause them to deviate. That Krishna is very kind to the devotee, and just like he was to Dhruva Maharaj. He said, you wanted these things, okay, you can have them. So if the devotee has desire for this or that, the other thing, and a desire for Krishna, if it's not only Krishna. So Krishna will put you in a situation where you can fulfill those desires, and then your devotional service is waiting for you to take up again. And we see this again even in this life. People who leave the strict practice go and fulfill this or that desire, and then they pick up again where they left off. So that can happen from one life to the next, and so forth. But when you pick it up, there it is. You know, and we also see that in this life, that when people take up spiritual practice, they very, very quickly achieve the level that they had in a previous life, which is why people seem to start at different levels. As Shiva Ram Maharaj talks about how when he was a teenager, he received Krishna book, teenager, early 20s, and must have been in his early 20s, because he was already in college. And he said when he was reading the stories, they all seemed so familiar to him, and he went to his mother and said, did you read me these stories when I was a child? You know, I seem to know all of them. And she said, no, I've never heard of these at all. So that's not an uncommon experience for devotees. You know, you go the first time to Vrindavan and you think, oh, wait a minute, I know this place. I've been here before. I know some devotees who lived in Mayapur for years and years and years, and they told me that there's certain places here where we just, as soon as we went to that place, we felt that we were home and we felt that we knew the place and so forth. But it may not appear immediately. And we find this even with the associates who join Krishna's pastimes. I was just reading this, I guess it was in Gopal Champu, how when Krishna showed the residents of Vrindavan the spiritual world in the lake in the Yamuna, the same lake where he showed the spiritual world to Akura, that Krishna was thinking that these persons are so absorbed in my human-like pastimes that they've forgotten that they're residents of the spiritual world. So that's true even at that level, that sometimes happens, that, this is who I am, and this is my... We find this happen with Dovamangala Thakur. He's another example where he had achieved a state of bhava in his previous life, and he took birth in a Brahmana family, very pious Brahmana family, that was also very wealthy. And with this high status and wealth, what we would call at the modern time high SES, socioeconomic status in society, he misused it. He became very attached to his girlfriend and his money and prestige and so forth. And it wasn't until he was older, I mean, not sure exactly how old, was he a teenager or a young adult, I don't know. He'd have to be at least like 15, 16, I suppose. But then again, through the grace actually of his girlfriend, he woke up again to the devotional service of his previous life. And then once he went to Vrindavan, he very, very quickly, I mean, he was seeing Krishna and associating with Krishna personally, so he very quickly regained his past level. I hope that answers your question.
That was great. Thank you so much.
Interesting, Mama Urmala. Very quickly, I just wanted to mention, you probably know Niranjana Swami is telling a story about this old Prabhupada's disciple. She had a stroke, and when she forgot everything, she didn't know her name even, and she needed to learn how to eat even. But she did remember, you know, when nurse gave her telephone, when Niranjana Swami called, the first thing she started to sing Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. And then said Jaya Srila Prabhupada. And when Venur's asking where you live, she said in Vrindavan. So anyway, that's probably another person that we're talking about.
It's completely another. I know her also quite well.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah.
She's passed away. She's left this world.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, what was particularly interesting about her is her only living relative was a niece who was very antagonistic to Krishna consciousness. And the niece arranged for this devotee to be in a nursing home very far from a temple, very far from the devotees. So it was quite interesting how she just had none of the support systems that we think about as being essential. But yeah, that was all she would do. The only thing she would do was just chant Hare Krishna and be in that mood. And Niranjana Swami was one of the few people who really traveled the distance, quite literally, to go visit her. I know of another devotee in Florida who's got Alzheimer's. And his wife told me that he's the most Krishna conscious that he's ever been. Previously, he was very, how should we put it? He was one of these people that spent a lot of time criticizing others and kind of had a very aggressive stance. And at this point, all he does all day is just chant. But he can't remember whether or not he's taken a bath. So he may go several days without bathing, or he may bathe 10 times in a day because he can't even remember something like that. Anything that he's done, you know, 2 minutes ago is out of his memory. And he can't remember practically anything of his life. So that's a pretty... how would you say, major surgery by Krishna. if somebody can't fix their mind on Krishna, he has them lose the ability to fix their mind on anything else. Anyway, better that we fix our mind on Krishna voluntarily, I would think.
Nice, thank you.
I liked the way you went through the modes. It's a very interesting subject, the modes of material nature. But I was thinking when you said something in reference to the cessation of miseries, when someone finally sees the material energy for what it is, a passing show, it is true that, you know, as much as we become aloof from material attachment, I remember, that's almost comical, I was complaining about
the modern age, some of the things you were saying, the way they grow food, everything. And Vishnu, Prabhu's wife, said, get over it, it's Kali Yuga. But anyway, one can become aloof from material attachment and the miseries diminish according to that, in that connection, as it goes to nil. Yet we saw Srila Prabhupada, he had so much intensity in his, you know, wanting to give others Krishna consciousness, you know, based on compassion. And so it must be categorically different. And also he mentioned that as long as we have a material body, there's going to be problems, and especially in old age, plenty of trouble comes to, even if we're aloof from the body, we're still connected with it in some way. Anyway.
All right, those two things. So right. The intense endeavor is usually manifest only in the mode of passion.
Right.
Generally, people in ignorance and people in goodness don't make intense endeavor, although for very different reasons. The people in the mode of ignorance don't make intense endeavor because they're very lazy and they don't want to do any kind of sacrifice. And the people in the mode of goodness don't make any endeavor because they feel internally satisfied with simple things that come of their own accord in a pious way. And they just don't see why to make a big endeavor for enjoying the world. Therefore, the big philanthropic activities are almost always done in the mode of passion. Although people in the mode of goodness do philanthropic activities, they don't tend to do them on a large scale with big endeavor. It's just not where they're at. Now, Krishna consciousness is not just pure goodness in the sense of equilibrium. So what differentiates Krishna consciousness is that we're not just trying to get to this equilibrium and detachment, but we're trying to get to this rati. And rati is intense. It's very intense. You know, as I said, rati is the name for Cupid's wife. And it's, we're not talking about some sort of equilibrium, disinterested affection as might be found in the mode of goodness. So a person in the mode of goodness might say, yes, I love everyone, I see everyone as divine, and they kind of have this, you know, benign smile on their face. You know, that mood. I meet some people who are in sattva gun, and they have this sort of about them. You know, this sort of floaty equilibrium thing. But that's not rati. Rati is intense. And if we look at the devotees of Vrindavan, they're not in this just floating in the Brahman thing. They're running at night through the forest to see Krishna. Yeah, they're running after Krishna to tie him up when he steals the butter. They're running to chase and touch him and be the first to touch him in the forest. They're always busy. They're perspiring. Mother Yasoda is perspiring, tying up Krishna and so forth. It's very, very intense. So, and this is the only thing that's going to cure us. Because just coming to this equilibrium of goodness, that's not going to ultimately satisfy us. We want something intense. We want the vyavichari bhavs, the waves. You know, it's nice to go swimming in a place where there's no waves, but we also like the waves. We don't want to have a boring life. We don't want just equilibrium. So Prabhupada's intensity in preaching was coming from his being in this Vrindavan mood. We don't want to cut off rati. We want to have it for the right source. And as far as the miseries, you know, they say that the Buddha said that pain is inevitable and suffering is a choice. So Our suffering comes from seeing things as the objects of our satisfaction. If I don't see something as an object of my satisfaction, then that thing is incapable of giving me suffering. It just is. You know, if I see that getting on this particular flight at this particular time is essential to my happiness, then if the flight's delayed, I'm going to yell and scream at the airline attendants. And if I see that my happiness is independent, I may be still stuck in the airport, but I'm not going to be disturbed. So if I see this body as the object of my happiness, which is basically how we see it, I want to do things in this world. I want to enjoy in this world. And to do that, I have to have a functioning body. I have to be able to chew. I have to be able to taste. I have to be able to digest. Otherwise, how am I going to enjoy food? And in old age, all of the functions of the body don't work very well. Usually the first thing that happens is you can't see as well as you used to see. You need glasses or some other arrangement. You don't hear as well. You don't taste as well. You know, maybe the body doesn't move as well. So generally, for most people in old age, not for everybody, but for most people, the five knowledge-acquiring senses and the five working senses and the mind also just get rusty. Now, if these are your objects of enjoyment, then you will feel pain. You will feel suffering. If they're not your objects of enjoyment, if your enjoyment is within, as Krishna says in the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, this indeed is actual freedom from all miseries caused by material contact. And there he talks about relishing and rejoicing in the self. Relishing and rejoicing in the self. And we have these words also with rati, atmarama, atmatushta. We have this word again in today's verse, trip, which means satisfied. If one is finding one's satisfaction within through transcendental senses and a transcendental mind, which can never be destroyed and which is not dependent on the externals, then however badly the external machine is behaving, it's not going to affect us. And we may experience this at least from time to time. And it's not just a matter of detachment. I mean, you can do detachment to be free of suffering in a mechanical way. That's the Astanga yoga system. You know, you can do it in a way of having detached pious work, karma yoga. You can do it through philosophy. I'm not this body. There's nothing to do with me. You can do it through mechanical, through meditation. You fix your mind on another object. You let go, and so forth. And anyone can learn how to be free of material suffering in that way. But being mechanical, it doesn't satisfy the self, yadyatma supersedity. But if we're really absorbed, if we're really, really absorbed in Krishna, the material miseries, we don't even notice them. This is what explains when Krishna killed Bakasura and afterwards he's coming to the residence of Vrindavan, they're embracing him, and they became unaware of the material miseries. It's not that they weren't there, but they were just not aware of them. So I think most of us in Krishna consciousness have at least some experience with this. That there may be certain things, maybe while we're chanting japa, maybe while we're in kirtan, maybe while we're reading the books, maybe while we're preaching, that we have some, or while we're dressing the deities, whatever. I mean, I know of devotees who say that, you know, they have arthritic knees, but when they're dressing the deities, their knees don't give them any pain. And I've had many experiences of being quite ill, and when engaging in Krishna Katha, having no awareness whatsoever of the illness, that it's like it's just not there. And then when the katha is over, then again, it gradually comes into my awareness. So this is, if one's awareness is in the reality, if one's awareness is not in the shadow, then it may stop us again. You know, if your flight doesn't take off, you may have to sit in the airport. So if your legs are broken, maybe you can't walk without crutches. But whether you experience that as suffering depends on attachment. You know, if my flight is delayed, but I have no attachment to that flight bringing me happiness, then I'll find some way to be happy while waiting in the airport. Is that clear?
Yeah, you just reminded me of Srila Shuddha Maharaj in his old age. Sometimes he would come out and he'd be slumped in the chair, and we could tell he didn't have any energy and was a bad health day for him. But if somebody came up with a good question, he'd raise his head and he'd straighten up in the chair and his arms would start moving and he would just, you know, forget everything. But it would go on sometimes for hours and yes. Then we'd lose him for like 3 days.
Yes. Yes. Yes, it's very much like that. And I think, you know, even on a neophyte platform, we have those experiences where when we become absorbed, especially here, this verses of the Bhagavatam are specifically about Krishna Katha. When we become absorbed in Krishna Katha or any service for Krishna, we don't even notice. We lose our awareness of the material miseries. They just go out of our awareness. We don't feel them anymore. We're not constrained by them. We don't feel them anymore. I mean, I personally had one instance when I was in China. I got really sick from the pollution. I'm very sensitive to air contamination. And I was really, really sick. And every day I was getting a little sicker and a little sicker and a little sicker. I even went to the hospital and they said, well, it's the pollution. It's very common. And it got so bad that I collapsed on the floor of the apartment I was staying in at that time. I was moving around a lot, but that particular day. And I wasn't even able to speak at all. I couldn't move. I couldn't speak. I mean, I was just finished. And the devotee I was staying with, her name is Gopi Gita, said to me, well, you know, Urmila, we have a class here tonight, and all these people are coming. And it's like I barely speak in a whisper, and I was like, well, can you tell them not to come? Can you cancel it? She says, no, it's not possible. You know, they're on the trains already. I can't even contact them. You know, they're going to be here. So what to do? And I said, just read me some lila. So I said, go, you know, get Krishna book. So she's just reading and reading and reading from Krishna book. And as she was reading from Krishna book, my awareness of the difficulty went away. I couldn't get up. I still couldn't sit up. And I couldn't function on that level. But I lost my awareness of the difficulty. And then it was the only time I've ever given a class, you know, like collapsed on the floor. I could not even sit up. And all these devotees came, and as the devotees came, I was able to speak about Krishna. And during that time, it was no difficulty at all. So, I think we've all had these sort of experiences. Maybe we just have them for an hour, or maybe we just have them for a day or a week or something, where by absorption in kirtan, by absorption in japa, by absorption in Krishna Katha, we lose our sense of the misery. It's not that your broken arm isn't broken anymore, although that's possible, of course, through mystic yoga. But it's not like that. It's not that the miseries go away like that. It's not that all of a sudden your wife speaks to you with sweet words and serves you your favorite preparation while she massages your feet. The miseries don't go away like that. I mean, they might, but it's more that our interest in them is gone. And as soon as we no longer see the world as the object of our enjoyment, then we no longer experience as miserable. We become just an observer of the world, And when we're really absorbed in Krishna, we're not even an observer of the world. We go into an internal state of consciousness where we're not even the observer. We're not aware. And at that stage, it says in Bhagavatam, the Lord is taking care of our bodily and mental functions without our awareness. But at least we want to have the consciousness of an observer of the world, which we have when we're absorbed in Krishna. That is bhakti yoga. That is the yoga that we're doing. The yoga that we're doing is not just some set of external rituals, which if we perform them properly in some ritualistic manner, we'll go to the spiritual world as our reward, which is the eighth offense on chanting. But bhakti yoga is really absorption of our consciousness, and particularly absorption of our attachment in the reality. Anybody else? I think we could take one more and then we have to stop.
I'll wait. I have one question, but unless somebody else. Okay, so just quick comment also on our absorption. There is examples also with some famous pianist who became old and his hands became very arthritic. He couldn't do anything, but when he would sit at piano, he would forget. His fingers suddenly, you know, would be working. Anyway, I had experience as I was an artist, young days, working very intensely, similar things, but I completely sick, but when I start painting. So I guess it's like, it's that our absorption, yeah, like you said. The question I had, you mentioned about that, just maybe little clarification, I'm not clear on, you said that we have to get rati first, and before we get rid of pride, which I understand your point, but then I have a doubt about, isn't it rati, to get rati is also, it's a mercy. And how is that exactly works? Can you a little bit clarify that?
Okay. To your first point, that even materially speaking, getting absorbed in something you love can free you from misery and allow function that's not otherwise there. That's a fact. And Prabhupada uses that fact as an example that if that's true materially, how can it not be so much more true on the spiritual level? So it is a fact, even materially, that if one becomes fully absorbed in something that one loves, and so, that even the bodily functions can change. As far as your other question, that it's impossible in one class to discuss everything, and to discuss everything from every angle. So for each particular class, one chooses one main theme and one main angle. And you're kind of going into a subcategory that I didn't touch upon. There is a relationship between giving up pride, and pride meaning I am this body, I am this family, I am this, and getting attached to the real identity. And what happens first? In bhakti, it's getting attached to the real identity that happens first. It starts with that. It starts with a taste. According to Rupa Goswami, bhakti starts with some taste for Krishna. That's the beginning qualification, some interest, some taste, some attraction to Krishna. So that is definitely the beginning of bhakti. And as we get some taste for Krishna, our pride and attachment in this world decreases. As that pride decreases, our attachment for Krishna increases, and so forth and so on. It's one is feeding off another. It's not that we fully get attached to Krishna and then fully our pride goes. It's gradual and proportional. What's the place of mercy? There is mercy at every step in bhakti. We can't do anything without mercy. At the same time, there is intense endeavor at every stage of bhakti. Although at the higher stage, it's not a struggle. Though it's an intense endeavor, like with Vidugda Madhava Prabhu's question, it's out of affection at the higher stages of bhakti. So they're both essential. It's not that one is essential without the other. like Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati said, if someone's in a well and you throw them a rope, you also have to grab the rope. If nobody throws you a rope, you can't get out of the well, and if you don't grab the rope, you can't get out of the well. What's more important than the other? You can't really say that one is more important than the other. What happens first? You can't really say that either. I mean, in one sense, there's mercy first, but mercy is in response to our inner desire. And our ability to even perceive mercy is also our inner desire. Even Agyata Sukriti, which gives us the basis for beginning of bhakti, it's still, kriti is meritorious, but it also implies some kriya, some action on our part. You know, you can give someone prasadam, but they have to put it in their mouth. So I suppose there's some situations where there's only mercy, like we're just chanting the holy name, and people are not really doing anything. But I suppose you could also say they're not covering their ears. Sometimes people walk past the Harinam party and cover their ears and make an endeavor not to hear. The person who shuts himself up in their room in the sunshine. So it's all mercy, and it's all endeavor, and it's both. And you can decide which perspective you want to look at. Of course, the devotee always feels that their endeavor is nothing, that no matter how much they endeavor, that they don't earn their way back to Godhead. That is a fruitive mechanical mentality that is the eighth offense. That's not bhakti. So if you think of endeavor as ahankara vimudhatma kartaham iti manyate, I am the doer, and I'm going to force my way, like Ravana's stairway to heaven. I'm going to force my way to the spiritual world by my austerity, by my etc. So it's interesting, in the 11th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives this whole list of things. One cannot understand me by worship, by austerity, and so forth. We can go there and read his list. Just give me a second here. That's at the end of the 11th chapter, where he says, the form you are seeing with your transcendental eyes cannot be understood by studying the Vedas, nor by undergoing serious penances, nor by charity, nor by worship. So then Srila Prabhupada, in the purport of the next verse, in the purport in text 54, he takes all these things, studying the Vedas, penances, charity, and worship, and explains how they're all part of bhakti. But if we think it's by my worship, it's by my penance, it's by my knowledge of scriptures, it's by my endeavor that I'm going to earn my way back to Godhead, that's a bunch of nonsense. It's by our attachment, and it's by mercy. Listen, even in human affairs, no matter how much I love someone and how attached I am to them, they have to choose to reciprocate with me. We have many examples in this world where person A is totally in love with person B and person B doesn't reciprocate. Of course, Krishna says, Yeya tamam prapadyante tamstadaiva bhajamyaham. Krishna says, I will reciprocate, but we should understand that it's still voluntary on his part. He's not a machine. And therefore, without that merciful reciprocation on Krishna's part, which, by the way, is always greater than any endeavor that we can make, there's no question of anything. So that's a bit of a lengthy answer, but it was a little bit of a complex question. Okay, I think we need to end now. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.